Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the first academic conference call of the semester. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. We appreciate your joining us. Today's call is on the record. The audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org, after the fact, if you would like to share it with your colleagues and classmates. We're delighted to have Robert Blackwell with us today to discuss the issues and contingencies around Iran's nuclear program. Ambassador Blackwell is the editor of the recent CFR e-book, Iran, the Nuclear Challenge. From 2008 to 2010, he was senior fellow at the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica, California. Previously, Ambassador Blackwell served from 2004 to 2008 as president of BGR International, which is a Washington consulting firm. He was deputy assistant to the president and deputy national security advisor for strategic planning under President George W. Bush, where he was responsible for developing and coordinating the mid- and long-term direction of American foreign policy. He also served as presidential envoy to Iraq and was the administrator's coordinator for U.S. policies regarding Afghanistan and Iran, and he is here in residence at CFR now. Ambassador Blackwell, thank you very much for giving us your time. It would be terrific if you would give us an overview of some of the issues that are outlined in Iran, the nuclear challenge, what we face vis-a-vis that country, and your policy recommendations.
Well, thank you very much, and it's good to interact with all you. Let me begin with a pitch for the e-book, Iran, the Nuclear Challenge. It's, first of all, only $2.95 on Amazon, but the reason I mention it in particular is that, unlike almost everything else written on this subject, it is not prescriptive. That is to say, it does not make policy recommendations, and I won't either. Rather, it's an attempt to be entirely analytical and to look at all sides of the major issues concerning dealing with the Iranian nuclear weapons program, but without taking a position. And as I say, that's something of a white rhino on the savannah here on a subject that is properly of great interest, strategic interest to the American elite and folks like you all who follow this subject. So, Iran, the Nuclear Challenge, $2.95, Amazon. Now, let me just begin, and I'm only going to go on for about 10 minutes here so we can have a conversation and I can hear what's on your mind. But let me do the latest on this subject. I know you've been following it to some degree. On August the 30th, the International Atomic Energy Agency released its latest report on Iranian nuclear enrichment, and essentially what it says is that Iran is steadily increasing its enrichment capacity. They're not sprinting, but it's a steady increase. So that's the first judgment. The second is that Iran is also steadily increasing the number of centrifuges at its Fordo site, and if you've come across that, it's near Qom, and it's a relatively new enrichment facility that is buried in the side of a mountain, so much more difficult militarily to deal with. So those are the two big judgments out of that. That report. Now, more generally, Iran's production of low-enriched uranium, 3.5%, has increased 60% since last year and tripled since 2009. So the Iranians are working very hard to increase its capacity, its reservoir of low-enriched uranium. And it's generally thought, you'll see this in the literature, that Iran has, to this date, enriched enough low-enriched uranium to produce 6 nuclear weapons if it chose to do so. So so, six nuclear weapons so far, if it chose to do so. Now, it is the, and I'll get to this a little bit later, it is the administration's judgment that the Iranian government has not so decided to acquire nuclear weapons, to produce nuclear weapons, but that it is moving steadily to increase its capacity to do so should it decide to produce those weapons. Now, sanctions, which are extremely tough, among the toughest sanctions ever passed by the UN Security Council, are biting hard in Iran. And again, this is somewhat anecdotal. Obviously, the Iranians don't themselves permit a systematic look at the effect of the sanctions on Iran, and they deny that it's had any effect. But it's had a dramatic loss, Iran, of its oil revenue. It has constraints on its international banking. Its economy is ever weaker. Its currency is ever weaker. Inflation is a problem. So the sanctions are biting hard in Iran, but apparently have not yet led the Iranian leadership to reduce this steady increase in its nuclear activities. And that's been demonstrated through three meetings that have taken place between the Iranian government and the so-called P5 plus one, which is the permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany, who have had three meetings, one in April, one in May, one in June, with the Iranian government to try to find a way to make progress on this issue. And there's been no progress, essentially. I think both the Iranians and the P5 plus one state that. No progress so far. Now, let me now say just a word about Israel and the United States, and this is very much in the headlines, including on the front page of the New York Times today. And there is a conceptual and operational difference between the United States and Israel's view of this matter, although their intelligence judgment of what's going on inside the Iranian nuclear weapons complex is now very close. But it's a conceptual difference, and it goes like this. Israel's view is that the bright red line is when Iran acquires the capacity to produce nuclear weapons. And the administration's view is that the bright red line is when Iran decides to produce nuclear weapons. So you see the difference between the two. Over last weekend, Secretary Hillary Clinton said in a public statement that the United States was not setting any deadlines for military action against Iran. And that produced yesterday in Israel a very strong, explicit criticism of the Obama administration by Prime Minister Netanyahu, and who criticized the administration for refusing to set clear red lines on Iranians' nuclear program. Indeed, the Washington Post, days ago, I guess about a week ago now, editorialized and said that the Obama administration should tell Iran that it will use military force. Explicitly say that, use military force if Iran moves toward acquiring nuclear weapons. So there is this difference of view between the United States and Israel on what the red line is. So that's basically the major issues. Now, I want to say just a few more words, and then I very much want to hear what you all think and have to say. We circulated, but only a few days ago, a chapter in the book that I wrote. It's the last chapter, and if you have a chance, you can look at it. But I only wanted to repeat these major parts of it and just to caution you all. The first is be careful about historical analogies in describing this problem. Both the people who believe we should use military force against Iran soon, and those who are against it both use historical analogies to support their view, and my own view is that that's a mistake. Ernest May, the great Harvard historian who passed away a few years ago, used to say, nobody uses a historical analogy that undermines their case. So that's the first big point, and there's more in that last chapter if you have a chance to look at it on that subject, giving examples. The second is to concentrate on the feasibility of various policy options, and this goes both to those who think we should use military force and those who think we shouldn't. But in any case, again, another book I'll suggest to you is one by Ernest May, I just mentioned him, and Richard Neustadt, the eminent Harvard political scientist. They wrote a book called Thinking in Time, and one of the things they say in that book is look at the feasibility. Will it work? Will it stick? Will it help more than it hurts? If you don't do this, what do you do? Which leads me to the next, which is think carefully about the day after, the month after, the year after, even the decade after, if we use military force, and think of those same parameters if we don't. And finally, unintended consequences of policy actions, which American foreign policy is replete with. Finally, let me just end with these questions, which we can discuss in our session. First, does Iranian possession of an actual or virtual nuclear weapons capability threaten U.S. vital national interests? And if so, in what concrete ways? What is the current pace of the Iranian nuclear weapons program, and could it be accelerated? How solid is the U.S. intelligence community judgment that Iran has or has not decided to acquire a nuclear weapons capability? Have all other policy options, including economic sanctions and negotiations to stop the Iranian nuclear weapons program, been effectively exhausted? What should be the specific objectives of a U.S. preventive attack against Iran if it were to occur? How many years would various U.S. attack options of what duration delay the Iranian nuclear programs? What would be the most likely Iranian reactions to various U.S. attack options? How long would such a U.S.-Iran war likely last, with what potential implications for the United States, its friends and allies, and the international system? What would be the strategic consequences for the United States if Iran were to acquire a nuclear weapons capability? How should the United States respond in the region and beyond if Iran possesses a few nuclear weapons or attempts to acquire a very large nuclear arsenal? So those are some central questions on the subject, and now I look forward to our exchanges.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Blackwell. Let's open up for questions from the students, please.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please press star 2. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. I will announce you by school only. Our first question will come from Bush School.
Ambassador Blackwell, my name is Josh Graham at the Bush School of Government at Texas A&M. Thank you very much for your time. Regarding one of your points is, would a nuclear weapon threaten a serious national security interest? I think that goes to whether or not Israel as a strategic ally, is it a national security interest? And so my question is, if Israel does a Syrian/Iraqi type of operation without an approval from our government, what would our policy options be, and what would you believe our response would be towards Israel, and then also in the aftermath of that attack?
I think I won't guess about what the policy response might be, but let me take you up on your good question. First of all, just, and you know this already, but again, you are analogizing and it I think demonstrates my point, analogizing to the Israeli attack on the Syrian reactor and on the Iraqi reactor. But it shows the danger of analogies, because each of those were one facility. If Israel were to attack the Iranian nuclear complex, there are many targets. And one of the problems the Israelis, and that's the reason I like your good question, the Israelis are struggling with is the United States, as we all know, has much greater military capacity than Israel, and therefore can perhaps wait longer than Israel to act if it decides to act, because it has so much more military capability. Israel's concern is that Iran is moving at a pace where at some point, and they may be very close to it, an Israeli attack cannot accomplish the objective of substantially setting back the Iranian program. So, again, there's a difference between the two on how they see the possibility of a military strike. The other thing I would say is that I think most American strategists think of, in the first instance, the threat to the United States' national interest, and it turns out that the threat to U.S. national interests and the threat to Israeli national interests are basically congruent. So if you were to enumerate the vital national interests of the United States, I think it's generally believed across the political spectrum that an Iranian acquisition of nuclear weapons would be a very serious long-term threat to the United States and, of course, to Israel, too. But we don't know how Israel will act. It, of course, is a sovereign government, and it'll do what it thinks is best for Israel. And I don't want to speculate what a U.S. reaction would be, but Israel, of course, is one of our closest allies in the world. And in this particular case, I think our objectives, which are stopping the Iranian nuclear program, preventing Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapons capability, are identical.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Kingsford University.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Abdullah Barak from Kingsford University. My question is, does Mr. Blackwell think that any further sanctions on Iran will make Iran more lenient in any future negotiations?
It's impossible to know that. It's a terrific question, but analytically, it's impossible to know. What one could say is that further sanctions will worsen Iran's economic situation. But whether that in turn will lead the Iranian leadership, and after all, this is hardly a democracy, it's a few very old men making these decisions, whether it will lead those few very old men to waver in their, as I say, at least to this point, determination to proceed, is uncertain. But I like also the question because it does raise another issue which needs to be explicitly stated, which is it looks as if there will be no more United Nations Security Council sanctions against Iran. As I said earlier, they are currently in place among the strongest, if not the strongest ever, sanctions, but both Russia and China have perhaps come to the end of the string on their willingness to vote for more sanctions against Iran. China, perhaps because of its energy dependence on Iran, and Russia because Iran is a neighbor and there's a long history of Iranian-Russian relations. So it looks as if now, this could obviously change, but President Putin said something consistent with what I'm saying just a few days ago, that if there are further sanctions of the kind that you mentioned, they'll have to be ad hoc sanctions from the willing and not through the UN Security Council. So your question is a very good question, but nobody knows the answer. And the United States and the Europeans in particular, but also the Japanese, the South Koreans, and others, are strengthening these sanctions in a systematic way. But whether they'll have the effect that that the United States and these and its friends hope is unknowable. I think it's what Don Rumsfeld used to call a known unknown.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from University of New Hampshire.
My name is Michael Cole from the University of New Hampshire. So I realize this is difficult to know for sure, any type of certainty, but are the newer targeted sanctions having any impact on the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps' profit that are primarily derived from their black market activities? From the research that I've seen in one of the RAND studies that were put out, it seems that multiple billions of dollars are derived from black market activities, and the previous round of sanctions were leaving the black market activities essentially unscathed. And this is essentially what is funding the advanced weapons research in Iran. So I was wondering if any of these sanctions are addressing the black market activities that are essentially overseen by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps.
You presuppose the answer, which is it's not in the public domain. And, of course, if the U.S. government knew the effect of these sanctions on those entities, those organizations, it would be through intelligence acquisition, and because they hardly broadcast the effect on them. And so there's nothing in the public domain about whether these sanctions are having an effect on the activities that you described.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question will come from Boston College.
Good afternoon, Ambassador. My name is Alexander Hayden. And earlier you talked about how there would be implications from war and what they would be. My question is, based on the fact that Iran's military, especially its Navy and Air Force, are not up to the par capabilities of the U.S. military, what would you see as being their specific retaliation against the U.S. or a combined joint force in the Gulf?
That would take a while, but it's central to the deliberations which would go into any use of U.S. military force. Before I get to that, let me just say, and again, stimulated by your question, if you are a policymaker, then these are not abstract matters that we're talking about, and they're not op-ed subjects. If you're a policymaker, what you realize, and especially if you're the President of the United States, is going to war is an enormously serious decision on his part. Indeed, it is the most profound decision an American president can make because it puts Americans so clearly in harm's way. So when one thinks about the various options about how to proceed, and you don't always get this from the op-eds from either side, one needs to think, well, that might not be a perfect option, but compared to war, it might be an acceptable option or not. But as Iran continues on its path, that binary choice looks more and more a possibility that the president will have to decide perhaps next year, if Israel hasn't acted before that, sometime in the next calendar year, to either use military force against Iran or to acquiesce in some way to an Iranian nuclear weapons capability. And so every decision between here and then, of course, will by the U.S. Will be an effort to try to avoid that binary moment, and through negotiations and sanctions and intelligence activities and others, to avoid that binary moment. Now, Iranian reaction, there's quite a lot about this in the book, but, and you're right that, of course, the Iranian military cannot match the U.S. military. No other military in the world can come close to doing that, but it has asymmetrical capabilities. For example, It could use terrorism against Americans all around the world. Indeed, it could bring through Hezbollah terrorism against the American homeland. It could use its missile force to strike American facilities in the Gulf. It could excite Shias in the Gulf, including through Saudi Arabia, into terrorist activities against the host governments there, and so forth. So it has asymmetrical capabilities, even though, as you say correctly, it doesn't have a military force that can match the American military force. But it also brings the issue of one of the questions I asked at the conclusion of my opening remarks is, how long would such a war last? And a man named Fred Akle, who's now deceased, but was a distinguished American strategist, wrote a very good little book, which I commend to you, the name of which is Every War Must End. And it's a book about war termination. But if you think about a war between the United States and Iran, which begins with an American military attack against Iranian nuclear facilities, it's a little hard to think how that war ends, unless you believe that Iran will simply say, we surrender. And the kind of asymmetrical attacks I was describing earlier could go on for years, and the United States would have to try to contend with that. So even though Iran's military capability is not great, its capacity to retaliate is not insignificant.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Richard Stockton College.
Hi. How reliable is the information?
I have a few questions because we know that in 1965, Israel stole 200 pounds of weapon-grade uranium from a company in Pennsylvania. Israel has an ongoing nuclear weapons collaboration with apartheid South Africa and has 400 nuclear devices. They start a war with somebody every 2 to 3 years. They have refused to sign...
I really can't hear. I don't know if that's a question or a speech. I can't hear exactly what's happening.
Is there a question?
Thank you. Our next question will come from University of Puget Sound.
Thank you, Ambassador Blackwell. Really appreciate your conference call this morning. One of the things you mentioned at the very beginning was the conceptual difference between the U.S. and Israeli approaches to the nuclear enrichment process in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about Israel having the capacity to produce as the big bright red line for them, and the U.S. is all about the decision to produce. But the problem here, perhaps it seems to me, is that intentions are really difficult to know, and decisions at the high level in terms of policy are often not disclosed in the public. And so is our intelligence or Israeli intelligence so sharp that we could know relatively soon after such a decision is made? And so perhaps, I mean, if the first indication we have of Iran's decision to produce nuclear weapons is that they actually do have nuclear weapons, it seems a little bit unwise to have this kind of a late bright red line. What would you think about that?
I think it's well put what you've said, and it is at the heart of the worry in Israel and the differences on the red line. The question is, would we know if they made such a decision, given that the circle of decision makers is so small in Iran and also so self-enclosed? The U.S. Administration thinks that if Iran were to make such a decision, that we would know fairly briskly. And indeed, Secretary Panetta said just in the last few days that we would have a year to deal with that. That is to say, once we knew they had made that decision, we would have a year to deal with that decision. The Israelis worry that that's an exaggeration and that the Iranians might make such a decision, might then especially in clandestine ways with clandestine facilities, move forward, and that by the time we knew, it would be too late. So you put your finger on the differences between the two, and they come from, as I said before, first of all, different military capabilities, and also different vulnerabilities. If you think of this, one last point, I know it's obvious, but it is worth saying that an Iranian nuclear attack on the United States is, first of all, unlikely because they don't have missiles that can get this far if they were to acquire nuclear weapons, and introducing nuclear weapons into the United States otherwise would be a challenge. Iran has missiles, which if it were able to weaponize its nuclear weapons, would be able to reach Israel. And so that's a very different situation. Of course, an Iranian detonation in the continental United States would be a terrible, terrible tragedy, and it could kill a million Americans. But an Iranian detonation of a nuclear weapon in Israel is not a million out of 320 million people. It's a million or more out of 5.5 million people. And obviously, that's a different dimension. But let me say one last thing. I've been in Israel twice in the last 5 months, despite the dust up here in the last 48 hours. Both the United States and Israel are working as hard as they can together to try to deal with this difference. So far they've narrowed very substantially the differing views, intelligence views of where the Iranian program is at the moment, but they haven't been able to narrow the difference of where the right red line is.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Washington University.
Hi, how you doing? My name is Parvin Rani. I was thinking the best scenario possible that if there's going to be, we know that there's going to be election, both in U.S. and Iran, as well as Israel in like next 9 months or so. Is it possible that the change in the leadership make people to kind of come together and let's say they let Iran to have the nuclear weapon and kind of trust Iran that they're not going to use it?
Well, I see there are these elections. The Iranian election, I don't think, is the same category as the Democratic election in the United States and perhaps in Israel. Israel and the United States will have election, but I don't believe, I think I'm in pretty solid ground here, that whoever is the next Israeli prime minister and whoever is the next American president is going to say, oh, well, it's all right if Iran acquires a nuclear weapon. I don't think that's going to happen. Both this Israeli prime minister and this American president have the same views as their predecessors on this subject, which is Iranian nuclear weapons capability is unacceptable. So I don't think the elections will change that view fundamentally or even in any way in either Jerusalem or in Washington.
Thank you. Next question.
Yes, our next question will come from the Colin Powell Center.
Hi, my name is Mohammed from City College. And my question is, as you mentioned in your talk before, that if Iran has enough enriched uranium already to produce 6 nuclear weapons, like, aren't we already too late in terms of any action? And the second part is, like, if Iran stops right now with their nuclear enrichment, how long will it take for them to revive? Like you said, their economy is weaker, their currency is low, their ranking is low, and their inflation rate is high. Thank you.
Well, that's maybe I'll try to do both of them. They're both good questions, but very, very complex. On the first issue, let me just say the difference between the current Israeli view and at least a substantial part of the American view. Israel says that Iran must give up all enrichment. It must stop all enrichment of nuclear material It must shut down its centrifuges, and it must export out of the country all enriched uranium that it has produced. Iran says it's out of the question that we will do that. The NPT treaty gives us the right to enrich in the full fuel cycle, and we're not going to give up that right. So there's an enormous difference there between the view that they have to give up everything and the view that the Iranian view is that they won't. The question then, and you presage this, is, well, is there something in between which would avoid war? And there are various ideas floating around out there. Probably the most prevalent one is, well, what if the Iranians are allowed some enrichment, but not enough in order to stockpile low-enriched uranium, which would produce nuclear weapons? But that would require Iran to export 5/6 of its low-enriched uranium that it has now, and to keep exporting it. It could never have more than enough for one. It could never have as much as enough to produce one bomb. So the Iranians have rejected that. But it's in that middle ground. We haven't said very much about negotiation. It's in that middle ground that if there's a negotiating outcome to this, that's where it will probably have to be found, somewhere between no enrichment whatsoever and enrichment, which the Iranians are now doing at a steady pace, acquiring more and more low-enriched uranium, which will allow them to produce more and more bombs, nuclear bombs, if they decide to do so. So that's where the negotiating space is, if there is any negotiating space. On the economy, let me just say, it will take, let's imagine that Iran tomorrow and the P5 plus one reached an agreement that was so widely negotiated that it would relieve the P5 plus one, especially the United States and the Israelis, of any worry about the Iranian nuclear weapons program, and therefore all sanctions against Iran would be lifted. The most important of those sanctions are the sanctions which have cut Iran's oil exports in half, and even now more than half. Well, if that were to, if they could export again soon, that would, of course, give an enormous boost to their economy. But their economy wasn't doing all that well before these sanctions, so it would take, even in the improbable case that we had complete comprehensive agreement on ending Iran's nuclear weapons aspirations and program, even if we had that, it'll take years for Iran's economy to recover.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from San Diego State University.
Hi. In regards to that last question, I think there's maybe some misinformation about the difference between highly enriched uranium, which is, you know, over 90%, and low enriched uranium, which is usually under 20%. And also, you had mentioned this dust-up within the last 48 hours, and I was wondering if you could comment on that political football a little bit. Do we actually have a red line now, and does this play into the politics in the presidential elections here between the Democrats and Republicans?
Well, on the last point, I'm not going to get into the domestic politics. If you just Google your favorite news source, you'll see that there is a intense American domestic political debate about the last 48 hours and so forth. But I'll let you read that on your own. But on the question of the degree of enrichment of uranium, you're right. There is a big difference between enriched uranium from 20% up to 90%. The 90, by the way, is weapons-grade material. and the 3.5% is low enriched uranium. But just to make this point, and you probably already know this, 20% enrichment is very far toward 90% enrichment. It's not one-fifth of the way. And so if you can get if you can enrich to 20, you're close to 90 if you make a decision to go that direction. Now, so far as we know, the Iranians have not enriched above 20%, but they are enriching at 20% now. And as I say, that gives them a breakout capability faster than having to go from 3.5%. But most of the enriched uranium in Iran now is at the 3.5% level. And as we've been saying, it's enough for 6 bombs, but they would have to enrich it to the 90% level in order to have weapons-grade material.
To follow up on that, it seems like 2 years ago, people were talking about in 2 years, Iran would be capable of producing a bomb, and it's 2 years later. And are they capable now, or...
It has been now, you're absolutely right, for a decade, a somewhat of a receding horizon here of how long it would take them should they break out and tomorrow say we're going to get a nuclear weapon and do everything possible to acquire one. I think it's now generally thought that, and of course there are always dissenters, and maybe they're right, but I think close to the conventional wisdom now is that sometime next year, if Iran continues on its current path, the American president will be, if the Israelis haven't acted before that, will be confronted with a decision regarding what to do about the Iranian nuclear program. That would have meant, by the way, that sanctions had not affected a change in the Iranian behavior, that Israel hadn't acted, and that negotiations hadn't produced an outcome acceptable to the United States and to its friends. And usually the timeline now is thought to be, although it's argued about it, no longer than the end of next year. Some people believe, as one of our earlier respondents mentioned, that we've already gone past the timeline because of the 6 bombs worth of low-enriched uranium. But, as I say, I think the conventional wisdom are close to it. Maybe the majority opinion, I should say, is probably by the end of next year we'll be pretty close to that binary moment.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question will come from Ohio State University.
Hi, this is Eric Leiden from The Ohio State University. Obviously, the Iranian nuclear energy program is widely popular with the Iranian people. It's, you know, a part of their nationalism. And so what I'm wondering is, if Israel or the United States were to attack Iran, wouldn't that raise enough nationalism and wouldn't that give them enough legitimacy? Do you think it might actually increase the risk of them developing nuclear weapons?
Well, that's discussed. I think that you put your finger on one of the big questions on this subject, and it's discussed at length in the book. First answer is nobody knows because there's no real public opinion polling in Iran for obvious reasons. So really nobody knows exactly what the reaction of the Iranian people would be. First, but there are some who think, there are some experts who think that they would fall in behind the regime, and there are some experts who think they wouldn't. So you can read up on it and become an expert yourself and come to your own view. On the issue of whether it would accelerate the Iranian program, there are, again, these two polar views and then ones in the middle that if the Iranian nuclear facilities were to be attacked by the United States or Israel, but especially by the United States, that it would solidify a decision in Tehran that hasn't been made yet, these people think, and would ensure that Iran, the first thing it would do the morning after is say to itself, well, we hadn't made the decision before this, but now that we've been attacked, of course we're going to acquire nuclear weapons and go to it, and continue to go to it, which presumably would mean periodic attacks over the years every once in a while by the United States to keep it from happening. That's one view. But another view is that isn't what would happen. What would happen is that an attack on the facilities would sufficiently set back the Iranian program that they might be willing to negotiate a reasonable outcome. So again, these are matters of judgment, and they're very complex. And the only warning I would give us all is that if someone sounds absolutely sure that they know the answers to your good questions, then you should suspect their response, because nobody really knows. You know, George Marshall, the great American soldier statesman, had very good advice to all of us who care about these matters, these foreign policy matters. Marshall used to, after he had come close to making a decision, would look at his colleagues and ask them in the most serious possible way, why might I be wrong? And it's a subject, if we have deep and abiding views on these matters, either concerning the Iranian nuclear program or what to do about Syria or U.S.-Russia relations, and we're absolutely sure we're right about both our analysis and our policy prescriptions, wouldn't be bad to take Marshall's advice and ask ourselves in the most serious possible way, why might I be wrong?
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question will come from University of Minnesota.
Thank you, Ambassador Buckwill. My name is Ido Sivan. I'm an Israeli student at the university, and I'm curious to hear about your opinion regarding Israel's foreign policy, about Iran's goals, and do you think that the world truly understands the risk, and what maybe can Israel do better? I would also like to know, how can you explain Iran's passion for a nuclear weapon, and how Iran-Hamas-Hezbollah relations affect Iran's public image?
Well, on the first, I'm not going to give it. I've said at the outset I wasn't going to give advice to the U.S. government on this. One of the things I like about our book is we don't do that. We try to be analytical, and I've tried to be analytical in my reactions to your good questions in the course of this discussion. So I'm also not going to give advice to the Israeli government, if you'll permit. But on the issue, the basic issue is Israel's preoccupation with the Iranian nuclear weapons threat understood outside of Israel? Well, certainly understood in the United States. I think it's understood by many countries, but not by all. And the reason is, and it's now back to Iran's own view of the world. If you're in Iran, and let's put aside the Iranian revolutionary rhetoric about changing the political configuration of the Middle East, which of course is a central theme of its public statements, but let's put that aside. There are nuclear weapons around Iran. Russia has them. Israel has them. Pakistan has them. The United States has them, and so forth. From the Iranian point of view, they may say, well, why shouldn't we have them as well? There's also the issue of the Persian Empire. This is a civilizational entity, Iran, based on Persia, as we know. And again, it's one in which they say, we have been a great power in the past, Darius, Xerxes, and so forth, and there's no reason we shouldn't be a great power as the international system evolves. So for those reasons, they may believe that they have a right to nuclear weapons. The problem is what they say about those nuclear weapons. That's the problem. Excuse me, just 1 second. My cell phone is going off here. That's the problem, what they say about it. And one of the things they say, including President Ahmadinejad, is that they're going to reduce Israel to a cinder. And so, and this is the kind of talk that one hasn't heard in five decades in the international system. So whatever Iran's motivations are, I've tried to describe a couple of them, although it's a complex subject, it's how they talk about acquiring nuclear weapons and how they think about it and how they characterize them, and also the suspicion really widely held in the region that Iran partly wants to use such an acquisition of nuclear weapons for hegemonic objectives throughout the Middle East.
We have one more question.
I'm sorry, we have several questions in queue, so I'd like to try to get other schools the opportunity, and then we'll try to come back to you.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Bush School.
Hi, this is Joe Aguiar at the Bush School. You kind of answered this question before, but I also have like a two-part question, so I'll continue.
Can we just do one part since we're almost out of time?
Yeah.
Right.
Can you just talk about how each of the parties actually perceive the Iran threat? What are the differences, would you say, between the way Russia views a potentially nuclear Iran and the way the U.S. and Israel view a nuclear Iran? Can you just kind of lay out the camps of where different countries stand on why Iran should not have a nuclear weapon?
Well, if we get past the rhetoric, and let me try to do this briefly, if we get past the rhetoric, I think there's really no difference between the United States and Israel in a practical sense about the nature of the Iranian nuclear threat. And that's because those two countries are perhaps the most likely targets if those weapons were ever to be used by Iran. So they're one category. Then I would say the Sunni regimes in the region, led by Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, are the next most anxious category with respect to the Iranian nuclear program. And indeed, one of the things we haven't had a chance to talk about, and we're about out of time, is the worry that if Iran acquires a nuclear weapon, that Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt will not be far behind, and then you would have a Middle East replete with nuclear weapon states ready to explode, to detonate. So they're the next category. Then the next category are the West Europeans, and they have supported very strongly the sanctions against Iran and the concern about Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon, but they're somewhat further away, and therefore perhaps the intensity is somewhat less. And I could go on, but let me do your point about Russia. The Russians don't want, I'm persuaded, Iran to acquire a nuclear weapon. But they also don't want a war in the Middle East. They don't want another demonstration of American military force after Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, the debate about Syria and should the U.S. use military force. For, I think, President Putin, there's been too much use of U.S. military force in the last decade. He doesn't want it used against Iran. So it looks as if the Russians have to choose between American military force or Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon, they might well decide a Iranian nuclear weapon is bad, but since we Russians can't conceive it to ever be used against us, a U.S. military attack would be worse. And then the Chinese, who, as I say, have great economic equities, energy equities in Iran, and so are along with the Russians, less enthusiastic about the notion. But I would say there's an overwhelming majority among the 180 or 90 countries in the UN General Assembly that Iran should not acquire a nuclear weapon. Overwhelming majority. But Iran has almost no friends, less than five, in the world on this subject, governments. However, those same 190 countries divide on whether military force is a legitimate response to Iranian nuclear behavior.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question will come from GWU.
Yeah. Question about the North Korea versus Iran. Could you comment on that with respect to the nuclear, possibility of nuclear weapons?
Well, again, I don't like to analogize, but I would just say this much, which is, of course, the Iranians have watched the various red lines that have been created with respect to North Korea, and now it has gone across every one of those red lines, has somewhere between 6 and 10 nuclear weapons, and hasn't been attacked. So we don't know what kind of conclusions that the leadership of Iran might draw, but you can bet that they're studying what North Korea's done successfully with great intensity.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question will come from Air Force Academy.
Hi, Joseph Lee, United States Air Force Academy. Ambassador Blackwell, in light of the Iranian Green Movement in 2009 and the more recent Arab Spring and Syrian civil war, more attention has been given to the idea of opposition support as a viable option to the Iranian nuclear problem. What do you believe the best avenues of support for opposition groups are?
Well, let me just say the dilemma that the administration faced during the Green Movement, I don't think it was quite a revolution, but the Green Movement in Iran, was they were at that time trying to reach out the administration to the Iranians and concluded that if they were to strongly support the Green Movement in Iran, that would end the possibility of a negotiation on Iran's nuclear weapons program. I'm now not making a judgment about the quality of that that view, but I think that was their view. And the same thing pertains now. We have a negotiation in train. There have been 3 meetings. If there is a possibility of a negotiation reaching agreement which would avoid war, then obviously and do so in a prudent and responsible way, which would promote American national interest, then we'd all like to see that. And any administration will have to calculate how support for Iranian domestic opposition would affect that. And there are a couple of views. One view is the more internal opposition to the regime, the better, because the regime may crack at some point. And there's another view that says one way to ensure no flexibility on the Iranian part would be for the United States to strongly support Iranian domestic opposition. So that's debated, and different people have different views on the subject.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we have reached the end of our hour, I'm sorry to say, and I know that there were other questions in queue. So my apologies for not being able to get to them. Ambassador Blackwell, thank you very much for your time today. We really appreciate it, and for your this terrific e-book that you put together, and I hope that all of you will take a look at it, especially at the $295 price. Ambassador Blackwell is the Henry A. Kissinger Senior Fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy here at CFR. You can follow the work that he's doing on our website at CFR.org, as well as a number of other experts who are in residence and doing policy research and analysis. In addition, we just released a ebook today from Foreign Affairs, the magazine that we publish. It's entitled Iran and the Bomb, Solving the Persian Puzzle. And it is a compilation of foreign affairs essays from over the years. So I hope that you will take a look at that. For the professors who are on the call, if you would like to request an exam copy of either that or Ambassador Blackwell's ebook, please email educators@cfr.org and we can send you a copy. Our next call will take place on Thursday, September 27th at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. Jendai Frazier, CFR's Adjunct Senior Fellow for Africa Studies, will talk about the Sudan and the conflict there. And you can also access the rest of the semester lineup at cfr.org/educators. So thank you.
Could I, before we sign off, thank all the students for their very good questions, and to say that one of the exciting things about foreign policy and public policy in general is that, of course, we didn't solve anything today, but if you read tomorrow morning's paper, there'll be more new wrinkles on the Iranian nuclear program, and it's a fascinating subject to follow, and one which, of course, is enormously consequential for the United States. So thanks for all your very good questions.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.